Fifth case of the day, Lott v. Pfizer. Mr. O'Malley.
Good morning, Your Honor. Your Honors, may it please the Court. The United States Supreme Court, in the recent Martin case, eliminated the presumption in favor of attorney's fees upon remand. The old Seventh Circuit Garvey standard was overturned, thereby removing the presumption in favor of fees as a matter of course. The new Martin standard permits fees only in cases that lack, quote, objective reasonableness or unusual circumstances such as where the party acted in bad faith. This new approach removes the thumbs from the scale that previously served to dissuade parties from removing cases. Although plaintiffs argued throughout the district court proceedings against Martin's application to this case, in their opposition to this court, they have now conceded that Martin does apply. However, plaintiffs mischaracterized Martin. Contrary to their argument, it does not apply a hindsight review to allow for fees in cases where the removing defendant's arguments are non-frivolous, reasonable, and with foundation. This reading turns Martin on its head and ignores its core objective reasonableness holding. Objective reasonableness is a well-known concept from other concepts in federal litigation. For example, in the Seventh Circuit's Hardaway case, an anti-terrorism and effective death penalty case, the Seventh Circuit has defined objective unreasonableness as something, quote, well outside the boundaries of permissible differences of opinion. Pfizer is not arguing that fees can no longer be awarded post-Martin. However, they should not be granted where a defendant bases removal on novel questions of law regarding a new statute that has not been addressed by relevant precedent.
Let me make sure I've got this straight. There are no members of the plaintiff class still employed at RAC, right? Oh, wait a minute. No. Sorry, wrong question. Yeah. I was thinking about the next case. Sorry.
That's quite all right, Your Honor.
My question to you is, wasn't it objectively unreasonable for Pfizer to argue that the plaintiff's damages could be aggregated to arrive at an amount in controversy of $75,000 when the general rule in diversity actions is against aggregation?
Your Honor, that is the general rule, but the plaintiffs are masters of their complaint, and at paragraph 50, they invoke the consumer fraud laws throughout the country. And that included the consumer fraud statutes from Louisiana and from North Carolina. And Louisiana allows for recovery by a single plaintiff of the entire attorney's fee award. And in North Carolina, they allow a single plaintiff to be awarded the entire excess profit earned by the defendant as a result of misrepresentations and concealment. We also argued the common fund doctrine, Your Honor. Under Price v. Philip Morris, because at paragraph 45 in their complaint, they didn't talk about $75,000 cases or less. They talked about many millions of dollars. And the court below found that the common fund doctrine may indeed apply, but the lower court did not believe our reading of the complaint of many millions of dollars warranted the common fund doctrine in this case. So for those reasons, Your Honor, we don't believe those arguments were objectively unreasonable. They were well within the boundaries of permissible opinion. And furthermore, Your Honor, we believe that the policy stated in Martin is such that removal is so important to the federal courts and the right to removal is not to be discouraged, that if there is one ground in the removal petition that is objectively reasonable, that warrants removal, then that is a ground that should not support attorney's fees. And Pfizer's CAFA arguments in favor of removal were objectively reasonable. First, the Class Action Fairness Act was a brand new statute at the time of this case's removal, and as numerous decisions have subsequently acknowledged, CAFA's language is hardly a model of clarity. The Ninth Circuit called it bewildering. Pritchett, the case followed by the Knutson Court in the Seventh Circuit, the Pritchett case from the Tenth Circuit, said the very term at issue here is arguably ambiguous. Second, Pfizer's CAFA justifications for removal were based upon case law from five different federal district judges that showed that in other related contexts, a case is commenced when it is removed from federal court. Third, at the time of removal in April 2005, no binding precedent existed on when a case commenced for purposes of CAFA, and only a few courts had yet spoken on the question. We did not have the Seventh Circuit's bright line that we now have from the Knudsen case and from the Shores case. In April 1, 2005, when we removed this case, there was no precedent in the Seventh Circuit for these arguments. And fourth, CAFA's legislative history shows that it was enacted exactly to expand the scope of federal jurisdiction, and Pfizer's CAFA removal theory is consistent with that congressional intent. Thus, Pfizer objectively, reasonably concluded that this case, which was served after the date of enactment and was removed within the 30-day period following the service of the complaint, was properly removed under CAFA. Commencement of the case was at the time of removal. But, Your Honors, we're not here to re-argue the appeal that we've already lost on CAFA, but we are here to point out that the cases that are involved in the CAFA arguments were, in effect, a split of authority. The Pritchett case relied upon the Kiefer case from 1959, which said that the time of commencement is at the time of the state court filing. In 1959, the Kiefer decision relied upon Pritchett. That was the minority view. Hunt and Lorraine had the majority view, which was that commencement was at the time of removal. And we think it also important to look at our Cedillo case that we cited below, because that was a removal case involving an expansion of federal court jurisdiction for pendant jurisdiction under the newly enacted Section 1367. And there, in a case where the Congress was signaling an expansion of federal jurisdiction, the judge found commencement was at the time of removal, and it supported removal. So we think, based upon this case law discussion, based upon the fact that the cases indeed show a split in authority, these judges that were on either sides of this question were not beyond the bounds of permissible opinion, and arguments that litigants developed based upon these this case law is not beyond the bounds of permissible opinion. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sigler.
Just curious about how many class action lawsuits were filed on February 17th in Madison County.
I'm not sure the answer to that question, Your Honor, but there were a number.
Plenty, right? Was the hotbed county for filing class action lawsuits.
There are a number of law firms who operate in that area, and yes, there are a number of class action lawsuits filed in that venue. There were a number of cases that were filed prior to February 2.
Any idea how many? I thought Madison County was the subject of some articles in the Chicago Tribune several years ago.
It has been a topic that's been covered throughout national press. The something that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has taken quite a bit of time to promote, yes.
And in the leading up to the passage of the Federal Class Action Fairness Act.
That's right.
Events in Madison County were...
Right. It was a venue that was discussed every day by proponents of that legislation. Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
If this case, then, is filed the day before the... If it waited the next day, it would have been filed in federal court. So you file it in Madison County. Do you question whether on that, that 30-day window there, that it was objectively unreasonable to try to get this case into federal court, given all the background that's occurred here?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. When I drafted this complaint, I considered it unremovable based on everything that was done with it and the date that it was filed. If you take a look at my timesheet, which is included in the record, you'll note that the very first thing that I researched was Rule 11. I didn't believe that the removal of this case, which happened on April 1st, and by the way, I thought it was an April Fool's when I was first told that this case was removed, was not objectively reasonable whatsoever. And my first call was to local counsel to request that he immediately withdraw that removal. Before I had a chance to file my Rule 11 motion, however, the district judge issued the order which rejected their CAFA argument and set the briefing schedule for the traditional diversity.
Yeah, how much of a chance do you have to win? Let's say they file this removal petition. They think we got a 5% chance to win. Is that objectively reasonable to do that? With a brand new statute.
Your Honor, their argument was that the word commenced meant removed. It was something that this court previously found to require a radical judicial rewrite of the statute to accomplish. So I wouldn't...
Well, not that that's a completely unheard of thing.
certainly not, but at the same time, when Pfizer was taking these actions, they knew that when they lost, they would have to pay my fees in getting the case remanded. Now, through a twist of fate, we're 2 years down the road, and they've got a shot of not paying those. So, I wouldn't say that that would just. But to answer your question, is a 5% chance objectively reasonable? No, I don't think a 5% chance is objectively reasonable. I think it needs to be.
Is it more like probable cause?
More than probable cause. Well, my practice is limited to civil practice, so it's a difficult question to answer. But it's certainly higher than the standard set by Rule 11. There can be no doubt about that.
I mean, lawyers don't always advance arguments that are surefire winners. They throw a lot of stuff up and hope something will stick, don't they?
And that's certainly what happened here, Your Honor. But that's not... what I'm suggesting that every removal needs to have to be a slam dunk in order to be there. But this one comes nowhere near such a line. There will be cases where Your Honors will be able to decide where exactly that line is, and this one comes nowhere close. Pfizer proposes an interpretation of Martin under which defendants like Pfizer will be able to subject the plaintiffs to years of litigation like they have to us without recourse when they can point to a single theory that hasn't been rejected by this court. That has been their argument, that although their theories were rejected by other courts and sometimes this court, they can give us their argument to you is that they can give you at least one argument that you hadn't expressly rejected. And since you had not expressly rejected that argument, that they had an objectively reasonable basis for removal and fees are not required. That goes much, much farther than the Martin standard allows. In Martin, the Supreme Court was presented with three different interpretations of 1447C. One of those interpretations by the Solicitor General sought to limit fee awards to those that were frivolous, unreasonable, or without foundation.
But had there been a circuit court ruling on commenced at the time the suit was filed?
There had been a circuit court ruling on commenced. The Tenth Circuit had denied the petition for leave to appeal in the Pritchett case prior to removal of this case. So they had affirmed the District of Colorado case on commencement.
There hadn't been much circuit law on the subject of commenced, right?
There had been no other circuit law on the subject of commenced. However,
to try to establish that, Mr. Ziegler, is that unreasonable?
As this court found when the commencement issue came before this court, the definition of commenced wasn't really the issue. As the Supreme Court had explicitly stated, the issue of when a Illinois state case is pending is an issue for Illinois state law, and there's an Illinois statute that's directly on point that says when it's filed. This case had been filed the day before the act was enacted.
You didn't have great delay here, though, did you?
I'm sorry?
You don't have great delay here with this removal. You had pretty quick action by the...
They removed within 30 days, but by the same time, there was no delay on the part of the plaintiffs. One of the cases they point to, Martin, the special circumstances the court talks about there, when the plaintiff's delay of more than a year and to seek remand. We moved for remand within 30 days. The district judge had rejected their CAFA argument within a week.
Right.
Are you also asking us to look at the reasonableness of their appeal on the remand order?
The reasonableness of the appeal on the remand?
Right.
I believe that the reasonableness of the appeal on the remand is also of an issue. At that time, there had been circuit court decisions, but Pfizer continued to plow ahead. We believe that the facts, their appeal, and then their delay again below in the district court in finding the fees and refusing to pay the fees show the purpose of the removal was just to delay and to incur additional costs on the plaintiffs and not in seeking a forum that was available to them. I just believe that those facts are circumstantial evidence as to the purpose of the removal, and as such would fall into the special circumstances exception stated by Martin. We are here today after 4 motions for reconsideration, 3 appeals, and 2 years still litigating an action for which there's no federal jurisdiction. To allow Pfizer to avoid fees here today is not the just result required by Martin. I believe the issue before the court today is a simple one that can be resolved with reference to just one case that was decided by this court less than 2 years ago. In Midlock v. Apple Vacations, this court reviewed a district court's assessment of sanctions under Rule 11 against a lawyer who had removed an action a second time without an intervening change of circumstances, relying on a single Northern District of Illinois decision. Likewise, in this case, Pfizer pursued what I believe is a frivolous course of removing this action, and like Midlock, only had district court decisions to support it. While there were numerous authorities contradicting those theories, and I'm speaking of the Herb U.S. Supreme Court case and the Illinois statute, Henry Shell, Henry Brand Name, Gibson v. Chrysler, these are all circuit court decisions that refute Pfizer's arguments. This court found in Midlock that the district court decision gave the appellant no support at all in his defense against Rule 11 sanctions. Well, now, while there's significant disagreement over what standard Martin puts forth, there's no dispute that Rule 11, the bar for Rule 11 is much higher than the rule for 1447C. Yet under the similar conduct, the similar circumstances presented in Midlock, this court found that an award of sanctions under Rule 11 was proper. For those same reasons, I believe that this court should affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. And to Judge Williams' question, looking at the at our appeal of the original remand order, I think if you do and you study the lot decision that was rendered by the previous panel of this court, you'll find that the court implicitly acknowledged the reasonableness of defendants' CAFA arguments, noting in a published opinion how this case differs from other cases in which similar arguments had been made. Quote, as Pfizer points out, there is a difference between the present case on the one hand and Knudsen and Pritchett on the other, close quote. Whereas accepting defendants' CAFA removal theory in Knudsen, quote, would have a dramatic retroactive effect, in contrast, removal here occurred within the 30-day deadline, close quote. There was no intimation in that opinion that any of our arguments were anything but reasonable. In fact, the ruling of fees below by the court never made it its basis for fees on any kind of frivolous argument ruling. He said it was simply an incidence of removal under the old Garby standard. And then later, he found that the same arguments were not objectively reasonable under Martin. But he did that without looking at the case law that we cited in favor of CAFA and failure to divine the case law that we cited and to look at the split of authority that existed there and to look at the fact that the case that Pritchett relies upon was the minority view of the split of authority, and we had the majority view from that case law, we think is an error of law such that it amounts to an abuse of discretion that merits reversal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Ziegler. Mr. O'Malley, the case is taken under